It's Thursday, May 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd, reporting from Washington. Coming up, Osama bin Laden's secret letters are released by the U.S. government. Some big banks are hit with big fines.
We're here to announce a major law enforcement action against international financial institutions that for years participated in a brazen display of collusion and foreign exchange rate market manipulation.
Can you clone a woolly mammoth? Some scientists say yes and no. And comedian David Letterman prepares to say goodbye to his hit television show. That's all ahead on VOA's International Edition. The U.S. government has released scores of documents it said were recovered during the 2011 raid in Pakistan that killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence said the material included personal letters to bin Laden's family, instructions to his lieutenants, and even how and when to use the Internet. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke to Seth Jones, the director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND, about what the release of these documents means.
What is the significance in a broad sense of the release of these documents? Typically, the intelligence community hasn't given their documents to the public. This time, they're doing it. Why?
Well, actually, this is part of a broader effort over the past several years to provide additional information about the way al-Qaeda's operated. There were documents released from this trove a few years ago. There have also been a number of documents released from al-Qaeda in Iraq. Many of them have gone to the counterterrorism center at West Point. These ones, though, were released directly on the Director of National Intelligence website.
Is there something that has changed in government operations or in the way the DNI is operating to facilitate this?
Well, look, we're living in an age where there's more access to information. In many cases, documents get released without the government's direct involvement. They get leaked in the case of Edward Snowden, for example, or with the WikiLeaks documents. In this case, these are documents that provide us a glimpse of the inner workings of al-Qaeda from its senior leadership, from Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and other senior officials. What they provide in this sense is transparency in how the organization operated. Now, it is important to recognize that this is only a very small tranche of thousands and thousands of documents from the trove captured at bin Laden's complex. So it's important to keep that in context and looking at these ones that are released.
We don't know what these documents are at this point. What if there are, for instance, documents that show cooperation or collusion by various governments or various actors or entities? This is kind of interesting because in releasing these documents, might there be some embarrassments?
Well, I haven't seen anything along those lines in these particular documents. There may be that kind of information in other documents that have not been released. Most of this information appears to be communications among al-Qaeda leaders and affiliates in places like North Africa. They discuss issues like the Arab uprisings and how to take advantage of them. So these are really, most of them are strategic-level documents not implicating neighboring governments, with the exception of some interesting information on some of the al-Qaeda affiliates that were and members and family members that were in Iran.
What is the public's benefit by this release? Is there any takeaway to this, or is it just a matter of transparency?
Well, I think it is important to understand an organization that continues to threaten the United States and the West more broadly, and not just the West, but also threaten a range of countries in Africa, in the Middle East, South Asia, and the broader Asia-Pacific Rim. The rise of the Daesh or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, there are a number of other organizations in addition to al-Qaeda that are providing a threat. The more we can understand these kinds of organizations, I think the better educated the population in these various areas can be. And what you really gauge, frankly, is that this is a social movement that's not going to go away anytime in the foreseeable future. And that's what people should come away with in understanding.
For more on this story, you can always log on to our website, www.voanews.com. Speaking of our website, for a look at how the Internet and social media are responding to this story, here's VOA's Michael Lippin. Michael, what are people saying about this story?
Thanks, David. Well, I can tell you our report about the U.S. releasing documents recovered during the bin Laden raid is the top story on our website right now, and it's attracted a couple of comments from our readers. Some of them don't think it was a good idea for the U.S. government to actually declassify this material. Reader Chris Mary from Abuja, Nigeria wrote, "This is not good for public consumption. May God protect us all." Another reader by the name of Brandon had some advice for U.S. officials, saying, "It's far wiser to remain silent on certain matters, and this is definitely one of them. It's doubtful whether the British government or the Russians would ever release documents such as this." That's Brandon's view. A third reader, Nash Davu from the Nigerian city of Jos, appealed to God to bring peace to the world and to help protect it from all forms of terrorism. Now, the VOA article also appeared on the Voice of America Facebook page, where several users gave their opinions of the former al-Qaeda chief. Urim Urimi Halimi from Brussels, Belgium wrote, "Legends never die, hashtag respect." Another Facebook user, Rajendra Prasad Kandel from the Nepalese capital Kathmandu, had an opposing view of bin Laden, writing, "Terrorists have a tragic end." Well, the bin Laden documents also have been a hot topic on Twitter. Analytics website Topsy says the words bin Laden have been mentioned in at least 46,000 tweets in the past day. David?
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. That's VOA's Michael Lippin. And we invite your comments on our stories. Just go to www.voanews.com.
What's new from VOA?
Do you still have a vinyl record collection? Some audiophiles say they prefer the sound of vinyl over digitized music. And records are making a comeback among younger listeners. Now a company in Japan is making turntables that can preserve and improve music on vinyl. Laser turntables. No metal stylus touches the record. And the laser sends pure analog audio to your sound system.
Music in vinyl records is more valuable than money.
ELP President Sanju Chiba says that's because analog music is more natural than digitized sound. His company's turntable focuses lasers on the parts of the grooves untouched by a needle. He says the sound is similar to the music of the master tape. The device doesn't come cheap. The base model is $14,000. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's What's New.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Five of the world's largest banks face nearly $6 billion in penalties for illegally colluding to manipulate prices in currency exchange. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said Wednesday that the fines were intended to show that no one is immune when it comes to currency manipulation.
Today's historic resolutions are the latest in our ongoing efforts to investigate and prosecute financial crimes, and they serve as a stark reminder that this Department of Justice intends to vigorously prosecute all those who tilt the economic system in their favor, who subvert our marketplaces, and who enrich themselves at the expense of the American consumer.
For our insight on this story, our economics editor, Jim Randall, joins me in the studio. Jim, why is this important? What were these banks doing that was worthy of these fines?
Well, we trust, as customers, we trust that the price we get when we buy or sell dollars or euros or whatever is being set by the market, not being set by collusion. And they violated that basic belief. And this is a zero-sum game. If they make more money, that means you and I make less.
U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said the fines were justified because the prices that we are to expect are supposed to be adjusted by the market. But is this really going to hurt these banks? I mean, these are the kind of institutions like Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase and Royal Bank of Scotland that deal with trillions and trillions of dollars every day.
The fines are big enough that they will definitely be noticed, and there's a lot of speculation in the financial press that some of the top executives of these very large companies will get fired or resign or be forced to resign.
How does this affect the overall financial market? Can people trust that when they do these exchanges that they will be actual honest currency-to-currency exchanges?
I kind of hope so. It's hard to say. I spoke with one analyst who said there are technical changes that you could make. It's very complicated, but you could make some technical changes that would make it more difficult to manipulate currencies, and perhaps that might go into effect in the wake of this.
All right. That's VOA's economics editor, Jim Randall. For more on this story, please log on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. Speaking of currencies, top officials of the U.S. Central Bank appeared unlikely to raise the key interest rate in June, as some analysts had expected. Notes from the most recent meeting at the U.S. Federal Reserve show that officials tried to make sense of disappointing recent economic data that show the economy is growing more slowly than expected. The summary was made public Wednesday after a three-week delay. The next scheduled meeting of the committee that sets interest rates is on June 16th and 17th. Coming up, can you clone a mammoth? Well, we'll find out from Roseanne Skirbel. But first, here's Dave DeForest with a look at what's making news.
Here are the headlines from VOA. The U.S. government has released scores of documents it says were recovered during that raid that killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. The material includes personal letters, a list of English language books recovered from his compound, think tank studies, technical manuals, and material published by other militant groups. The Islamic State has apparently captured the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says Syrian forces had withdrawn from nearly the entire city by late Wednesday after heavy fighting. Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Wednesday international inspectors will not be given access to his country's scientists or military sites under any nuclear agreement. He also said Iran will not give in to excessive demands. I'm Dave DeForest, VOA News.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, could mammoth clones roam the Earth anytime soon? And David Letterman calls it a career after 33 years behind the desk. That's all ahead. Stay tuned. One of the summer blockbusters highly expected this year is another Jurassic Park film. You'll remember in the first films, they took dinosaur DNA and recreated the giant reptiles who've been extinct for millions of years. But could you really do that? Could you bring a creature that has been long gone back to life? Well, that's a question that's answered in a new book, How to Clone a Mammoth, The Science of De-Extinction, by author and scientist Beth Shapiro. Roseanne Skirbel interviewed Ms. Shapiro. Roseanne, can this actually happen?
Not exactly.
What is she talking about in this book?
Basically, you cannot clone a mammoth because there are no live mammal cells. So you can't do it. It's impossible to clone it, like Dolly was cloned in the mid-1990s.
Dolly the sheep.
Dolly the sheep was cloned and lived about 6 years. But what she's talking about in this book, and she talks about mammoths, but other animals as well, is that you can take the genomic sequence and that DNA and then take its closest relative, animal relative, which is an Asian elephant. You could insert by cutting and pasting, genetic engineering, if you will, and grow bit by bit this new animal that is something mammoth-like. But to bring back a mammoth, no.
Okay, so is there a move to do this kind of thing, or is this just more theoretical?
There is a group, actually, at Harvard University that is interested in this. But not exactly for the reasons of the Jurassic Park idea, to bring back a freak show, as it were. What they're thinking of is if you can bring back the traits of a mammoth, you may be able to engineer those into creatures that are on the brink of endangered or threatened or endangered of going extinct.
Now, has this kind of thing been done with anything that we could look at now, or is this just something
This is something that genetics and the science of genetics is working out in that realm, and backbreeding. But, you know, you have to ask a lot of questions. Why would you do this? I think that what people are hopefully realizing is that we are a part of nature. We are not the masters of nature. We're finding this out with climate change and how our environments are changing. So why would you really, really want to do this? And the way the author, again, answers that question is that we can help in a conservation way. In that way, she says, it's a very powerful tool. But is there a place for it? How would you know, bringing back species affect ecosystems? And is it even technically possible? They're so far away from it now. It's a long way. But the exercise is worth it, in the sense that they are looking at characteristics of traits that might be useful in helping support species that are alive today.
All right, that is Roseanne Skirbel. You can see her report about this subject by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. And in the search engine, just look for the word mammoth. I'm David Byrd in Washington. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
After 33 years, 16 Emmy Awards, and more than 6,000 broadcasts, legendary broadcaster David Letterman is calling it a career with his final show. But what does Letterman's career mean for television and for the talk show itself? To talk about that, I'm joined by Ron Simon, who's a curator at the Paley Center for Media in New York. Mr. Simon, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
David Letterman, what does his career mean for broadcasting and for the talk show format in particular?
Well, certainly David Letterman has had a remarkable career. He begins in the analog television days. In fact, he comes out of broadcasting so that he knew all the rules of comedy and talk show. He certainly learned so much from his mentor, Johnny Carson. But the thing about David Letterman is that then he broke all those rules so that he's the bridge to two different generations of comedians. He's the one who absorbed everything you needed to know for the first era of television, and then he brought a whole new hip sensibility to another era of television.
He also was famous for some of the bits like stupid human tricks or stupid pet tricks or running over blank with a steamroller or dropping something off the top of a building in Midtown Manhattan to see what would happen. Is that reflective more of who he is, or do you think that those were things that you mentioned he broke the rules and so he just did them to kind of wink and stick it in the public's eye a little bit?
No, I think there's a quiet rebelliousness to David Letterman. He was someone who always wanted to push the limits of comedy. And you have to remember that when he began his late-night talk show on NBC, it began at 12:35, he was the first person to ever do a talk show that late. So he was given freedom to develop a different type of way of relating to the audience. Originally, he was told just to relate to the young male college audience, so that he was able to think about comedy very differently. Then he brought a lot of those experiments to a more mainstream audience when he joined CBS in the early 90s.
And it wasn't just comedy. He was also known for his very poignant reflections on 9/11, for introducing his heart surgeons when he had quintuple bypass surgery, and for making a public admission of having had an extramarital affair and apologizing to his wife. There's very few people who would do that, and very few, if any, other talk show hosts.
You know, the nice thing about David Letterman, you could see him mature over the years. Certainly when he was on NBC, he portrayed himself as very isolated, very maladroit at any type of social connections. He was very uncomfortable in his own skin. But during the CBS years, you saw that he took on larger challenges, and he revealed more of himself, certainly with big historical events like 9/11, and also more personal turmoil, whether it be his surgery or his problems with the extramarital affair. But he was able to, I guess, grow more comfortable in himself to talk to the audience about more private, personal matters.
All right, that is Ron Simon. He's the curator at the Paley Center for Media, and he spoke to us from New York City. Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. To see videos or photos from some of the stories you heard on our show, log on to our website, www.voanews.com. That's also where you can post your questions or comments. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Today's program was directed by Tracy Carter. Aydin Erkut was our engineer. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political turmoil continues in Burundi, with top government officials being dismissed following a short-lived effort by some military officers to take over the government. On May 17th, 5 days after the takeover attempt, President Pierre Nkurunziza issued a decree relieving the foreign, defense, and commerce ministers of their duties. Even as the president made his first public appearance in Bujumbura to show he was back in command, street protests continued there over his plans to run for a third term. Opponents say that violates the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement that was key to ending a deadly 13-year civil war. Announcement of President Nkurunziza's candidacy triggered street protests, which police tried to repress with water cannons, tear gas, and live ammunition. Estimates are that up to 20 people have been killed, hundreds injured, and hundreds detained over almost 4 weeks of demonstrations. Meanwhile, intimidation and violence by the ruling party's youth militia ahead of the planned May 26 legislative and June 26 presidential elections have caused tens of thousands of Burundians to flee to neighboring nations. The United States is deeply concerned by the potential for further bloodshed, including reports of retaliatory violence following the attempted seizure of power. We urge all parties to seek reconciliation and unity over revenge and retribution during this extremely tense period. We have acted to restrict travel for Burundian individuals who reportedly have committed human rights abuses and will consider additional measures against anyone who plans, participates in, or orders widespread or systematic discriminatory violence against the civilian population. The United States supports no effort by the military to take over power by unlawful means. We continue to believe that adhering to the compromises contained in the Arusha Agreement, including its presidential term limits provision, is key to returning stability and unity to Burundi. Thus, we hope that President Nkurunziza will weigh the best interests of his country and his legacy as he considers whether to continue his controversial bid for a third term. His candidacy will undermine Burundi's economic and democratic progress. Some international donors have already cut or suspended financial aid. The United States welcomes the mediation efforts by the United Nations and African Union and urges all Burundian stakeholders to participate constructively to find a peaceful, democratic resolution to the current crisis. We particularly welcome the announcement by the International Conference on the Great Lakes Region of the visit of the presidents of South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania to Bujumbura in the coming days to meet with all parties. Burundi has come far since the end of the last civil war that caused so many deaths and human suffering. The United States reiterates its strong support for the people of Burundi at this very difficult time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.